I'm Justin Mason.
I'm Vic Andrews.
And this is True Country.
Who are we talking to today, Justin?
Kyle Koronis, nicknamed Trigger, from Saving Country Music.
What is Saving Country Music?
Very good question, Vic. It is a website. It's a social media presence. A big following on social media.
I would argue he seems to be a movement.
I would agree with that. I see this guy's stuff on my feed all the time, and I understand how the Facebook algorithm works. So I'm interested in his stuff, so I understand why it keeps popping up in my feed. But I've been watching his stuff for several years now. I've seen his following grow, more lengthy articles, more opinionated columns that he writes.
And there's a lot of people out there that are following him because it seems to me he pops up on my feed all the time too. What he has to say is really interesting. Not a big fan of the Nashville scene per se, maybe a few folks, but he's putting out there his opinions, unfiltered, uncensored. And there's a lot of people that seem to agree with him about country music, the current scene, and what he has to say.
And what I find fascinating too, it's not just local yokels like Vic and I over here, talking about this guy. When he writes an article, I've seen the actual artists and labels and a bunch of other people get pretty pissed off when they read his columns. So people are reading his columns even on Music Row in Nashville. And so he's pretty well known, and what he's doing is definitely getting some traction, or already has some traction.
Well, I want to see what he's doing and up to with this Saving Country Music thing. Let's get him on the phone.
All right, let's give him a call. Here we go.
This is Kyle.
Hey, Kyle. This is Justin Mason. How you doing?
Hey, Justin. How's it going?
Good. Vic is here with me. He's my co-host.
Kyle, we're really excited to talk to you today. Saving Country Music. Tell us a little bit about it, how you got started, what you're doing with it.
Well, I started about 10 years ago. It's been 10 years since April. And I started it. It's kind of an amalgam of different things that came together. I had been reading a bunch about the outlaw country music movement back in the 70s, reading the biographies of Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings. And at the same time, I was noticing the struggle that many of today's artists were going through that was similar or parallel to the same problems that the artists were having back in the 70s with creative control of their music, being able to record the songs they wanted and with the players they wanted and the style they wanted. And so I saw a need for sort of a new movement, modern outlaw movement, to make sure that to inform people about the struggles that country music artists go through compared to artists of other genres, as well as put it all in a historical context.
Now, this is interesting right off of the bat because the industry has changed a lot, and you're seeing artists today that are having some of the same struggles as the classic artists from when this whole genre began.
Oh yeah, I think country music has been, I think country music is incredibly predictable in how it happens. It's very cyclical, and those same cycles have come and gone so many times, like from the very beginnings of the commercial application of country music. Ralph Peer, at the Bristol Sessions, recording hillbilly singers that he brought in to, with his little recording microphone, all the way to today. It's the same fights, it's the same cycles, it's the commercial interests of the industry fighting back against the creative efforts and inspirations of the artists. And so it's all cyclical, and it's all happened. And as soon as the business gets too commercialized, the artists fight back, and then all of a sudden, creative exploration and freedom comes back into play. And then, when that gets a little too far and nobody's making a lot of money, then they start bringing back in the reins. So, the fight to save country music is an ongoing battle. Country music will never be saved. And even if it was, it would need to be saved once again, because it would immediately start reverting back to the same old cyclical habits of the genre.
Tell me about 2008. You're reading a bunch of books. I understand you play music yourself. What were you noticing going on at that time in conjunction with what you're reading that forced you or had created this urge inside of you to start a website and start posting stuff? What were you seeing? What was going on?
Sure. Well, it, it was very specifically had to do with Hank Williams III. He was signed to Curb Records, which is a major Nashville music row label, and he was trying to release his music. And Curb Records basically wouldn't allow him to do it. They wouldn't allow him to do it his way and in a timely manner. They kept his music sort of hostage from him. And so that was the main thing. Is I was a Hank III fan. His early records were very neo-traditional, very traditional country, great songwriting, great singing. And he was really the guy that got me excited and showed me that there was actually an independent movement in music, that the country music wasn't just Garth Brooks and Brooks and Dunn and Shania Twain. Nothing necessarily against those artists, but you know, it was like that was one side of the music, but there was another side. There was an independent side. And so I was a big Hank III fan of those early records. And then all of a sudden I wanted to hear more. And I started delving deeper, and I found out that Hank III was trying to release music, but Curb Records was not allowing him to. So I said, okay, I'm going to do something about this. For example, you know, Hank III had to sign basically a gag order, mm-hmm. a non-defamation
And it
clause.
Wasn't just Hank III, too, at that time, right, with Curb?
Well, Hank III was the one that was making sort of the most noise about it until he had to sign that non-defamation clause so that he could actually start releasing music again. But that was this was the thing. At that time, when I started, the website very first started as an organization called Free Hank III. And since Hank III couldn't speak about what was happening because of this non-defamation clause, I was speaking with it. And, you know, DJs and fans and other artists, we were basically became the mouthpiece for Hank Williams III. Now, through that, you know, at the time all this was happening, people thought, oh, these are just a bunch of, you know, surly punks and malcontents and, you know, angry traditionalists that are just making a big stink about nothing. Well, subsequently, what happened was, first off, it was revealed all these other artists that Curb Records and Mike Curb had done wrong over the years. Leanne Rimes and, I mean, even people in the rock world like Frank Zappa. I mean, there were tons of people. Merle Haggard, he got signed to Curb Records, and then they wouldn't promote his record. So there were all these past offenses from Curb Records. And then right after Free Hank III sort of succeeded in getting Hank III's final record out on Curb Records, and so he was again sort of a free agent, Tim McGraw had the same, well, not the same exact problem, but he had a huge problem with Curb Records. Curb would not release his final record so that they could keep him under contract. So they kept putting out compilations and greatest hits. Like, if you go back and you look, Tim McGraw now has more greatest hits albums mm-hmm. out than he has actual
remastered
albums.
Super remastered. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. Like, they just kept on putting out these greatest hits records, as opposed to putting out his last record so that they could keep him on the label.
Now, let me ask you this, because I've heard this before, and in my mind, I kind of understand both sides of it, but from my standpoint is, if you let him do his last album, yeah, you're going to have to pay up if you want to sign him again, but then you're going to get to keep him, and you're going to have a good reputation, and other people are going to stay with you, as opposed to pissing him off and then getting into legal battles with him. And now your reputation around, you know, Nashville is kind of going down the tubes. Is it really worth all of that, or would it have just been easier for them to let him release it and treat him right and sign again? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, definitely, like with Tim McGraw, the situation became so high profile that it worked against what Curb was trying to do. One of the reasons that Curb signed Merle Haggard later in his career is because they wanted to boast that they had Merle Haggard on their label. Same with Tim McGraw. So when they're approaching younger artists, they can say, hey, we have all these great legendary artists. Look how many number ones Tim McGraw has had. Look what a successful career he's had. As soon as he's off the label, they don't have that enticement to newer artists. I mean, the trapping of music row is that, you know, artists have a dream. They want to make country music, and their dream is to be on the radio, to play the Grand Ole Opry, to play in front of, huge crowds, right? And they'll be willing to do anything to make that dream a reality. And unfortunately, you know, artists tend to make bad business people, and they tend to make bad decisions because they're following their dreams. They just want to sign to a major label on Music Row, and then they just hope that it's going to work out. And, you know, for a lot, it does. But for some, it doesn't. And, you know, for Tim McGraw, it worked out for many years for that guy. He had a huge early career. He started off strong and was very strong for many years. But then, you know, Curb decided they weren't going to release that last album. And then it really hurt Tim McGraw's career. And I think it definitely eventually hurt Curb Records. But one of the reasons it did, not to toot my own horn, but it's because there were people willing to speak out in Tim McGraw's behalf. And before then, there really wasn't that, because a lot of the media, country music media, is just an extension of the industry itself. Mm-hmm. There's not to say that's 100%. There's some great journalists, independent journalists and independent minded journalists that definitely hold feet to fire. But generally speaking, you know, just like, you know, an up-and-coming artist doesn't want to rock the boat too bad and lose their label deal or say the wrong thing. Same goes in the journalism world, where, you know, if you say something bad about Curb Records, you may not get that interview with that big artist. You may not get that exclusive song premiere. And so you have to play too. And when Saving Country Music came along, it was like, look, I'm going to tell the truth, and I'm going to, you know, express all of this stuff and give, and be an industry watchdog and a gadfly and whatever it takes to make sure that any artist, regardless of what their music is given creative control over that music, you know, to a reasonable extent.
So enter Kyle Coronis with Free Hank 3, enter the DJs and the fans. Clearly there was energy behind this, because it snowballed into Saving Country Music. So tell us how, after the Free Hank 3 effort, you obviously had all of these people behind you and with you. How did it turn into Saving Country Music after that initial
effort? Well, when I initially started it all, I did have kind of a bigger picture in mind. But, you know, when I first decided to start this whole thing, one of the biggest inspirations is I would talk to people all the time, you know, as a fan or as a musician or what have you. And people would go, what has happened with country music? And, you know, all over the place, it seemed like I was running into more people who were wondering what was happening with the music, why it was going so downhill, than people that were rah-rah, you know, and saying, hey, this is great stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like there were millions of people out there that were disgruntled about the direction of country music. They just needed a voice. They needed a, you know, a rallying point. And, you know, when I started Saving Country Music, there was nothing like that. There was absolutely nothing. Now you go on to Facebook, you know, there are sites like, you know, there are like pages that have literally 500,000 to 1 million likes that are just dedicated to hating on pop country music, you know. And you know, honestly, that's not what I want to do. Like, you know, that I try to be a lot more pragmatic.
You're more thoughtful in your approach to it.
Hey, yeah, there's some good pop country out there, and I think you've got to be, if you're going to be honest, if you're going to be an honest broker, you have to be honest both ways. Yes, there's a lot of bad mainstream country music out there, but there's also some really good stuff. Like today, I posted a review of Kenny Chesney, a new Kenny
about
Chesney
about the boat,
song.
The boat
written.
Song, yeah.
Yeah, Better Boat. And, you know, it was co-written by Travis Meadows and Liz Rose. Great song. Excellent song. I have never written, I've written neutral stuff about Kenny Chesney, but I've never written a positive review for Kenny Chesney in the 10 years that I've run Saving Country Music. But, hey, if he's going to release a song like that, I'm going to go out of my way to, you know, to say, hey, this is what we want. This is great country music. And if we have more of this, you know, then that's going towards the effort to save the genre.
So from the get-go, you had a long-term plan with this. You're talking to all of these people that agree with you about the music that they're hearing and the industry, and are willing to give it a shot. What was your long-term strategy? Are you thinking, I'm going to use this to have Music Row put out better music, or just, I want people to understand that you have an option and there is more out there, and maybe it'll force, you know, the Kenny Chesneys of the world to put out a song that they want to hear?
Yeah, I'd say there's a little bit of both of that. I mean, definitely the idea from the very beginning, the way that Saving Country Music is created, the way the website works, is not to preach to a choir. And so I have a lot of, you know, there's a lot of traditionalists and purists and like underground and independent country fans and artists. They don't like me. And the reason they don't like me is because they don't think that I'm staying pure to the cause, you know, because I will write a review for Kenny Chesney, you know, or I will champion a mainstream artist. They think we should keep it only independent. But the whole idea with the site is to grow the flock, not to preach to the choir. You know, I want to find, like you said, I want as many people as possible to understand that they have better, healthier alternatives out there to listen to, and that better music results in more enjoyment, more fulfillment. You know, I mean, a catchy song, sure, you know, like I get it. You listen to a catchy song and it's fun and everything. You tap your toe and you're trying to get through your commute and you just want something to sort of let your mind turn off. But if you listen to a song like Kenny Chesney's Better Boat, you know, like, you know, it's fulfilling. It makes you a better person. It makes you happier even when the song is ended. You know, it gives you a perspective on life that makes you a better person, and you relate to your family better, and you're just a kinder person, and you're smarter and you're wiser. And so, you know, I really think that good music results in good people, and bad music can result in bad behavior and bad people. And so this is really important stuff. And I don't say that judgmentally, because, you know, I want more people to listen to this music. But, you know, as far as like on a personal level, you know, I didn't have really any long-term plan when I started Free Hank 3 or Saving Country Music. You know, I don't like to talk about the fact that I'm, you know, I don't talk about any personal music endeavors that I have through the website, but, you know, I was a musician and I was also a writer, and my A1 passion in life is music. So, you know, Saving Country Music just gave me an outlet to share stuff. When I find an artist that I really believe in, the thing I want to do the most is share it. I believe that music sounds better when it's shared. And so, like, when I was discovering a lot of these independent artists, I just wanted so badly to share them with the rest of the world, you know, and the same goes for causes or issues or news stories that may pop up. It's like, I want to share this stuff. Like, when I find an artist, there was an artist, that I started listening to last week named Cliff Westfall from New York, you know, and I got his record and I listened to it and my eyes just got huge. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so great, you know? And when that happens, I'm like a little kid, you know, I just want to share it so bad. I just want to tell the world. It's like when you're in love or something, you know, you want to stand on the crest of the Titanic and, you know, like, shout it out to everybody.
Hold a boombox over your head playing Peter Gabriel in your eyes. Yeah, I hear you.
Exactly.
This is just my opinion, but with all of the options available for streaming and the way we consume our content, it is far easier to just hit play and listen to what you're given, almost like the radio from 10 years ago. But this is difficult to go out and find good music and go look for it and discover it yourself. How much of a challenge was it for you to get this going when you're essentially swimming upstream against the current?
Sure. Well, I think you can't take it for granted that people know that they have better options. I see this on the website all the time in the comment section. You know, people will say, hey, screw those people. If that's what they want to listen to, if they want to listen to crap, you know, they can. A lot of times people will compare it to McDonald's, you know, millions and millions of served. But those people don't, you know, they don't understand that they have options. And that's why you have to let them know that. And the way you do that is through criticism. Criticism is the way that you create those avenues for music discovery. That's why when I write negative reviews, there's actually a positive outcome, or if I do my job right, there's a positive outcome. Because what happens is even passive music fans will hear a song or hear an artist and they'll go, what is this? And then they'll take to Google and they'll end up on savingcountrymusic.com. And then I've got them. Then I can share them, you know, share with them other alternatives and better music. That's kind of the whole, like, that's the underlying mission of the site. I'm sorry, I forgot the first part of the question that you asked.
Well, no, that's a great answer. And hopefully that helps to dissipate the echo chamber a little bit when everybody listens to the same stuff and thinks that everybody is, you know, equally great when there's so many other options out there. But the first portion of that question was, what were some of the challenges when you're launching this? Because like you said, it's tough to be a critic when everyone else thinks that so-and-so is the greatest thing because that's all they're hearing. So what was it, some of the hardships or the tough parts of getting this to where it is today?
Sure. Well, from the very beginning... Well, okay, this may get a little too technical, but at the very start, Saving Country Music started on MySpace, okay? If you remember MySpace.
I remember that, yeah.
Google that, kids. You'll find MySpace.
So I was living on the West Coast at the time, which is where MySpace started. You know, I was living in a portion of the country where MySpace, like, took off real quickly, okay? And to me, it was awesome. Like, that's how I discovered a lot of the independent bands that I ended up championing. Because, you know, before then, there was nothing like that. In MySpace, to me,
right,
I didn't know it as, like, a social network. Like, to me, this was a place for music and
music
fans
platform.
Of music to come together. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was a musical platform. It was the precursor to... Spotify and all this other stuff, you know? And so, you know, that's where, but then guess what happened? Like I right at the peak of MySpace, I was like a MySpace god. Like I knew so much about that thing, man. I had so many friends. I knew how to do HTML. My page was like so souped up and like all this stuff going on and like everybody knew me. And I was like this, you know, I was like a god on MySpace. And then guess what happened? It completely and utterly got eradicated. And I hated Facebook because Facebook did not have the musical aspect to it. You know, it was too clean. I liked the fact
that
MySpace
was dirty. And at the time, it was pretty basic. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, so when all that happened, when MySpace imploded, I went to my web developers, and luckily I had some really smart people to help me at the very beginning. And they did it for cheap or free. They did it for, you know, 12 packs of Pabst and Natty Ice, you know, they put together and, you know, and I explained to them my dilemma. I was like, look, when MySpace was around, I was a god. Now I'm nothing. I'm starting basically back from zero. So how do I do this and not get screwed again? And he said, look, we're not going to do this through Facebook. We're not going to do this through Twitter. And I don't even think Twitter was around at that time. Said, you're not going to do this through a social media. We're going to do this through the power of Google. We're going to do it through search engines. That's how you're going to create a market advantage. That's how you're going to be able to reach the people that you want to. And so that's how Saving Country Music was created. And that still is established today. Not to say I don't have a big social media presence or a robust social media presence. I do pretty good, but the vast majority of people that come to the site come via Google. And the vast majority of the people that come to the site have never been to the site before or haven't been to the site in the last few months. They're unique viewers, as it's called, technically. And so, I'm reaching a lot of people.
What do you think these folks are searching for? Just the Nashville artists, top 10, that kind of stuff, or?
You know, it just depends. I mean, some of them are disgruntled country music fans. Some of them are looking for alternatives. Some are, they may like pop country, but they just don't like a particular song or artist, and they end up on the site. Sometimes, and there's a lot of times where, an artist, a mainstream artist is frustrated, like Tim McGraw or, someone else. Like, for example, Eric Church just put out a video with Ray Wiley Hubbard. oh gosh, I'm going blank on the song name, but you know, they just put out a video, and in the video, as opposed to like he's acting kind of like a shady drug dealer or something, and instead of the FBI hunting him, on the backs of their shirts it says EMI, which is his label, you know, and like. And so, like, his label is, like, pursuing him, because the way Eric Church put out his last record is he recorded it in secret, and then he gave it away to all his fans. And to do that, he sort of had to battle his record label. And so when things like that happen, people start to get insight on, like, okay, wait a second here. There's a war going on that I may not know about. That's artist versus label.
On our next episode, Kyle Coronas tells us what's next for Saving Country Music, what true country is to him, and more. Listen in.